Mormon Stories Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation. All donations to Mormon Stories are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonstories.org. So to what extent was this pioneer migration sort of just something that anyone could have done versus one of the greatest, you know, epic feats of 19th century Americana? You know, what was Brigham's role, and how important and difficult of a task was it to migrate to Utah?
I think in terms of getting a company west as of 1847, certainly challenging, but not unusual. You know, there are thousands of Americans who were going to Oregon and California during these years. That last section of the Mormon Trail into the Salt Lake Valley was both more physically challenging in terms of terrain and much more unusual. So I think there were greater challenges there. I think it is, you know, it's noteworthy that Brigham Young is able to get the pioneer camp to the Salt Lake Valley with nobody dying and with the people sticking together. And it's even more remarkable that over the succeeding years, he's able to get thousands and then tens of thousands of Latter-day Saints to Utah, to a large extent with a common purpose and a great deal of cohesion. I think in terms of westward migration, you know, that ultimately is very remarkable.
Once Brigham Young sort of establishes his leadership and his rule in Utah, what was his role? What was the separation of church and state, and to what extent were they kind of commingled?
Well, they were very, very commingled. I don't think there was any sense that there should be a clear separation between church and state. There was a civil government, of course, but Brigham Young believed that the priesthood should dictate to his governorship, for instance, and he certainly believed that the priesthood should control the politics of the territory. So, you know, he and other church members would make decisions about candidates for political office when there were state or then territorial elections, and people would vote for them. And, you know, theocracy is such an ugly word in the United States today. Brigham Young sometimes used the term theodemocracy, that we presume that this must have really irked a lot of church members back in the 1850s. I think there were things about Brigham Young's leadership that irked people, but I don't really think it was the church's political control of Utah. People for the most part seem to accept that. And in Brigham Young's mind, people had chosen to join the church through baptism. They had chosen to follow him and the priesthood west from Nauvoo. They had chosen to come to this sanctuary. And so they had chosen to follow the directives of the priesthood, and they should continue to do so.
One thing, John, Brigham Young was clearly in charge of things when he got out there. And I personally had not realized until a few years ago how many members of the church that were members during the Nauvoo period had sort of stopped on their westward trek in Iowa. Mm-hmm. And we're just kind of living there. Mm-hmm. And I can understand why, because the church has sort of bounced around between places for ever since its existence. And I think that they were kind of going to say, well, let's see what happens here. Is Utah going to be the place, or is there going to be some other place is the place?
Right.
And so Brigham Young makes it out there in 1847. There's tons of people that are on the trail in 47, 48, 49. But there's still a ton of people living back in the Midwest who are Mormons. And then in 1850 and 1851, Brigham puts out the call and says, you know, get yourselves in gear and get out here.
Right.
And that gets a lot more people out there.
Sure. Yeah, go ahead, John.
Had the you know, prophecy about Zion and you know, the New Jerusalem, had that been officially, you know, neutralized, or were people still hanging on to Independence, Missouri as the place?
Hmm.
Do we know?
Well, maybe Morris would like to reflect on this as well. Brigham Young talks about, you know, returning to Jackson County occasionally. Sometimes he makes statements to the effect that this is going to happen relatively soon. I think during the Civil War in the early 1860s, he talks about perhaps the Latter-day Saints returning to Jackson County within 7 years. But it doesn't seem to have been a central feature of his hopes and dreams.
Yeah.
once they get to Utah. You know, it's maybe more the way a lot of Protestant Christians think about the return of Christ. You know, once right. in a while you get excited about the thought and think it might happen soon, but most of the time you're busy with the practical tasks, you know, before you today.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a very good analysis, John. I think that's exactly what people thought.
Yeah, who'd want to go back to Missouri at that point, right?
Well, let's hope we don't have any listeners who are true Missourians and take offense at that.
No, I just mean at that point in the 1850s, after what had happened, how many of the saints would have wanted to go back there, right?
Yeah.
Well, I think that you're probably largely right about that.
You know, I'm just curious. You know, we talked about him being a craftsman and then a missionary. It seems like the tasks that he had to embark on in the Utah Territory, you know, building up, you know, being a governor of a territory and eventually building up an entire economic system. I mean, that's not the stuff he was raised. It's not like he was raised as a corporate or a political, you know, heavyweight, right? I mean, what an interesting thing that task, you know, was put upon him. You know, talk a little bit about how he was or wasn't prepared and what that was like for him and how effective he was at doing something that you would think that he just was not prepared to do.
It's a great question. Well, I mean, ultimately he is very successful as a colonizer. You know, he sends groups of Latter-day Saints to establish all sorts of settlements and economic missions in Utah. Quite a few of those economic missions, you know, say growing cotton or producing iron, don't work out. But in the process, you know, the Mormons, you know, settle rather vast territory. And he imbues those sorts of economic tasks with a strong sense of sacred purpose. So that you know, there's a lot to his success in that as well. In terms of, you know, being prepared to be a political leader, you know, he's governor of Utah for most of the 1850s. He's superintendent of Indian Affairs. You're right. I mean, he didn't have the background that you would maybe expect someone to have, except that he, as leader of the 12 and then as leader of the church starting in 1844, he's certainly used to making decisions that affect large numbers of people. I don't think he, until later in life, develops some of the skills that would have been useful for him as governor. And, you know, I think it was hard for him to interpret the changing nature of the U.S. government during these years. You know, he's pretty isolated in Utah, despite, you know, sources of news from elsewhere. And I think that's a bit of a handicap.
You know, John, one of the things I think that has plagued our church in its formative years is it seems like wherever we have gone with this philosophy of gathering, we become sort of a big political force, and it causes problems with neighbors. It did in Kirtland, again in Missouri, and again in Nauvoo. And now in Utah, 10 years after the Saints arrive, we have a war going on. And maybe you could tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, it's a different sort of problem, because in those earlier instances, you're quite right that the principle of gathering certainly created a lot of political opposition, because you'd have Mormons quickly become the majority, say, in a county or region, and then that would be very threatening to non-Mormons. Brigham Young very much wants to go somewhere after Nauvoo where there are no old settlers, as people used to call, you know, old residents of an area. So he wanted to go somewhere without, you know, other white people, really. And there were only a handful around the Salt Lake Valley when the Latter-day Saints get there. But then, yeah, of course, it creates opposition. Not so much because the Mormons can, you know, elect their own to all of the political offices of Utah. There are hardly any non-Mormons in the territory in the 1850s. So, you know, that's just kind of a natural result of the migration. The real conflict comes from clashes between Brigham Young and outside political appointees for the territory. Since Utah is a territory, while it has its own elected legislature, Washington has a lot of control. It appoints the governor, and President Fillmore appoints Brigham Young. But then there are lots of non-Mormons who are appointed as judges and officials for the territory. Brigham Young doesn't think that they should have any control over things in Utah, these outsiders, especially these non-Mormon outsiders.
They're sort of like carpetbaggers, right?
Yeah, they're carpetbaggers, very much so. You know, it's anti-Republican for a people not to be able to govern themselves, in his mind. So he tends to make the lives of these outsiders rather uncomfortable. It's kind of a natural clash over political sovereignty. And these officials and a collection of others, including some U.S. Army officers, either go back or write back to Washington with stories of theocracy and polygamy. And newly inaugurated President James Buchanan in 1857 gets several reports of Mormon disloyalty and Brigham Young's failure to acknowledge the sovereignty of the U.S. government. And he decides to send an army to Utah with Brigham Young's replacement, a non-Mormon replacement. And I think Brigham Young and a lot of Latter-day Saints see the approaching army, about 2,000 or 2,500 individuals, as another mob. And so he prepares to resist.
And this becomes the beginnings of what leads to the Mountain Meadows Massacre. Is that right?
That's correct. Brigham Young mobilizes Utah's militia, the Nauvoo Legion, to prevent the army from reaching the Salt Lake Valley in the fall of 1857. He seeks to form military alliances with Native leaders across the territory. He instructs his people not to sell grain or other supplies to Gentile immigrants who are passing through the territory. And I think that that response creates a very explosive situation. And it's as this potential war is emerging that the Mormon militia in southern Utah massacres a group of 120 men, women, and children who are on their way to California. The exact reason for the massacre is still, in my mind, somewhat opaque. This wagon train, you know, certainly had some conflicts with Mormon settlers as they passed through the territory, and those seem to have crested in Cedar City. It was pretty well-to-do wagon train with a lot of livestock, and I tend to think that, you know, John D. Lee and Isaac Haight, you know, organized this attack on the wagon train partly as a way of enriching themselves. And, you know, they round up a group of Paiute Indians who were very friendly with the church to attack, to ambush this wagon train. The attack ultimately is not successful. I mean, a number of the emigrants are killed, but it turns into a standoff. The Paiutes don't want to keep fighting, and eventually John D. Lee and Isaac Haight and probably William Dame instruct the local militia to finish the job, and it's, you know, they trick the emigrants into giving up their weapons, and then they slaughter them.
And
I think,
go ahead, Marcy.
I was just going to say, I think it's important too to place this, the general attitude in Utah. The Mountain Meadows Massacre was, in a sense, a small part of the Utah War, and was even not a main part. It was the most horrible part, probably, or definitely. But the siege mentality that was in Utah at the time, here, a lot of Utahns, I think, felt, here we are again. It's like Nauvoo and like Missouri. They're coming against us. What do we do? And Brigham Young went to the point of announcing that they were going to burn Salt Lake City if necessary, if the federal troops entered and tried to take it over. He sent people out to search out hiding places for the Mormons in the mountains. Again, one of my ancestors was one that was sent into the mountains in eastern Nevada, of all places, to find places where they could hide. And so you had people feeling like they were under attack, even if, in fact, they weren't. And that, no doubt, was a contributing factor to what happened at Mountain Meadows.
Absolutely. No, I think that's the case. Who is your ancestor, Morris, by the way?
Edson Barney. He was a man that was on the Zion's Camp March and was one of the first Quorum of 70. Not particularly prominent, other than the fact that when he died, he was the oldest living member of the church and had been a member longer than anyone. He lived to age 96. He was about Joseph Smith's age.
So, John Turner, you know, two of the burning questions people have, and the way you discuss the narrative might even sort of answer the question as to what your opinion is. But the two questions people have are that are kind of burning are, number one, you know, did Brigham Young order the Mountain Meadows Massacre? And even if he didn't order it, to what extent should he be held responsible for the rhetoric and, you know, the environment that might have nurtured a sense of fear and even millennialism and ultimately violence? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't think there's evidence that suggests that Brigham Young ordered it, or at least not. You know, not very much. There are some scattered references, say, in California newspapers, and, you know, which quote William Dame as saying that he was acting on orders, that he couldn't go against counsel. But I think for the bulk of the evidence that we have suggests that Brigham Young didn't order it. And I still think a key piece of evidence, which has been scrutinized by many people, is the letter that Brigham Young writes to the leaders in the South, to Isaac Haight in particular, at the time of the standoff. And he says, you know, don't meddle with the emigrants, let them go. He also does say, if the Indians want to kill them, you know, that's fine. And, you know, he says that in a number of contexts in September of 1857, in August of 1857. So it's not as if that letter necessarily paints him in a great light overall, but I do think it's exculpatory, you know, exonerating in terms of the specific question of him ordering the massacre. I do think, you know, if whether you want to blame President Buchanan for sending the troops to Utah in the first place, and one could argue that the federal government had more pressing issues as of 1857, or whether you want to blame Brigham Young for how he responded. And I think ultimately, I don't think his response was wise. It's certainly true that something like the Mounted Meadows Massacre would not have taken place in any other year or any other moment in Utah's history than in 1857, at the height of this military standoff.
Right. You know, it's easy for us to judge looking back. I'm just wondering to what extent you felt sympathy for Brigham Young or for the environment that might have led to the massacre. I mean, the Saints had been just continually driven out from place to place to place. And there was probably, you know, the government had sent an army. So there was a lot of reason to fear and a lot of probably a well-deserved persecution complex. Did you ever find yourself feeling some sympathy for the difficulty and the trauma that the Saints had experienced that would make it more understandable why they would think about violence as a reaction?
No, I think it's a reasonable question. You know, I've had a couple of people read my book, especially when it was in manuscript form, and suggest that I was, you know, too critical of Brigham Young for his leadership during these years. And I think you're right. I mean, I think, you know, that context, you know, does make his response, you know, somewhat understandable. At the same time, it was not wise for Brigham Young to repeatedly thumb his nose at federal authority in the 1850s. He had supported sending a rather incendiary petition or epistle to Washington early in 1857, you know, basically making threats against outsiders who would come to the territory. You know, I kind of forget the particular contents, but also the treatment of some of the federal officials that came to Utah was at the very least pretty shabby. And I think, you know, I think that those sorts of injudicious actions, certainly are the reason why President Buchanan decided to replace Young as governor and send an army to Utah. I don't think that Buchanan certainly didn't come into office intending to take action against Mormon Utah. I think he just concluded that from a series of things that he had to do something. He wasn't quite as vigorous against fire eaters in the South, as Brigham Young rightly pointed out later on. But, you know, maybe that's what I was referring to before in terms of Brigham Young's early lack of political skill. I think initially when he was able to intimidate and then run off several federal appointees, I think he got the sense that he could act with impunity and not expect a harsh response from the federal government. And I think in many ways then he's caught unawares when Buchanan decides to send the army to Utah.
Before we leave Mountain Meadows, the final thing that concerned people, and I think that was sort of not even discussed in the latest book on the Mountain Meadows Massacre that was put out by the Church History Department. To what extent, number one, was Brigham Young sort of complicit in a cover up of trying to fool federal authorities into thinking that it that it wasn't the Mormons, but instead the Indians who did it, or that the Mormons weren't involved. And then to what extent should we, you know, feel sadness or frustration or judgment about Brigham, about how he sort of hung out his what some call his adopted son, John D. Lee, to kind of be the fall guy so many years after the event. Talk about that alleged cover up if you can.
Well, I don't feel sorry. First of all, I don't feel any. Well, this sounds unchristian of me to say, so, but I'll say it anyway. I don't feel any particular sympathy for John D. Lee taking the fall, since he was clearly guilty, and never struck me as the most savory human being in Utah. You know, sometimes people ask the question of, you know, well, how can good people do something so terrible? Which is a reasonable question to ask of many of the people involved, but it never struck me as terribly applicable to John D. Lee, who definitely had good and charming moments, but also had a pretty mean and violent streak that showed itself at other moments besides Mounted Meadows. I don't know why I felt the need to castigate John D. Lee posthumously in this conversation, but,
right.
You know, the problem is not that Lee is punished, it's that nobody else is. You know, that's the miscarriage of justice. I think it's hard for us to understand Brigham Young's response. I think, you know, the way you asked a question about the Utah War is also quite applicable to, you know, the question of obstructing an investigation into Mounted Meadows. It's clear that at the very latest, by August of 1858, so about a year afterwards, Brigham Young knows that John D. Lee was on the ground at Mounted Meadows, and some other Mormons were as well. And I'm pretty certain he had a pretty clear sense of who the most culpable were pretty quickly. He was very well informed. And yet Brigham Young does not excommunicate Lee for another 12 years, and on occasion says rather callous things about the victims at Mounted Meadows. Sometimes he'll, you know, he tells federal officials that he'd be more than willing to cooperate in a fair investigation. I think he sees most federal investigators as simply desiring to use Mounted Meadows to strike at the power and security of the church and strike at his own person. And so his response is largely characterized by inaction. I think, you know, for Brigham Young, what was of foremost importance was protecting the church and himself. And I think he saw little to be gained from a full airing of what had taken place at Mounted Meadows. And yeah, he may well have thought that if he took vigorous ecclesiastical action against people like John D. Lee and others, that, you know, that could also have created trouble for himself. And even if he didn't, even if, say, in that letter I referenced earlier, even if that exonerated him from the specific charge of ordering the massacre, you know, his wartime policies, you know, would certainly raise some eyebrows among American officials, you know, encouraging Indian attacks on wagon trains. So I think he, you know, there's good reason why he was cautious, even if I think retrospectively on a moral level, it's hard to come to terms with.
Morris, any final questions about Mountain Meadows?
No, I think we've done well as far as covering the basics of Mountain Meadows. I do think that it might be useful maybe at this point to drop back to the question of plural marriage once he gets to Utah, because that, of course, that whole setup changed a lot with the saints there. And another thing that is going on during certainly the 1850s is what's called the Reformation in Utah. And that may, the rhetoric of the Reformation have played into Mountain Meadows, the Utah War, other things. It kind of all is related, but I think we haven't talked a lot now about the Reformation and polygamy.
Sure. Why don't we start with a little bit more on polygamy then? Just to get the story up to speed fairly quickly, Brigham Young begins assembling a larger polygamous household on the trail west. He still resides with Mary Ann Angel, and when he builds a large residence in Salt Lake City, the Beehive House, she is the only wife to live in that residence during its earliest years. And then later on, she decides to live elsewhere. And his first plural wife, Lucy Decker, moves into the Beehive House. At various points around 15 of his wives live in a second mansion, the Lion House in Salt Lake City. Other wives who don't want to be part of a communal household find Brigham Young willing to build residences for them either elsewhere in Salt Lake City or ultimately elsewhere in the Utah Territory. So for his wives, it's a tremendous diversity of experience during these years. Some were very contented as members of his household. Others found this sort of arrangement hard to stomach. There were some who very much resented his lack of attention for them. And some were discontented to the point where they asked for and received divorces from Brigham Young. I believe 8 women received divorces from him.
Out of how many total marriages?
55 by my count. There are a couple of cases that I consider ambiguous, but I go with 55 is the easiest answer to that question.
So over a 10% divorce rate.
Yes.
Okay.
And there were some others that simply didn't come west at all, that simply stayed in the east and just drifted out of Mormon history entirely. So, reasonably high percentage of what you could certainly call unsuccessful plural marriages.
And one thing too, John, you might talk about, I think a lot of people have the idea that in polygamy, lecherous old men went after young women and convinced them to marry them against the young women's wish. But as I understand it, in Brigham Young's case, there were a number who really solicited him as a marriage partner, many of whom he turned down.
Yes. And there were obvious theological and economic reasons for that. At first in Nauvoo, Brigham Young talks about the need for all women to have their choice. Very strong emphasis on that women should have agency and be able to choose. And a lot of women choose him. And by the 1850s, probably earlier than that, he realizes that, he doesn't want to be married to and support 200 wives. So he slows down his rate of marriage considerably. And there's some interesting cases. There are a couple of women in the 1850s who write him letters and ask to become his wives, and he turns them down. But in 2 cases, they were very persistent. And then many years later, he is sealed to them. So there are a lot of just fascinating, histories of the wives, not all of which I was able to fit into the book.
And do we have a sense, a couple things, how did he arrange his, let's just say, domestic visits of the different wives? Were they scheduled by calendar? Did he have favorites?
Well, the second question is easier than the first. He definitely had favorites. And sometimes that changed over time. Emmeline Free very much was a favorite wife, especially through the 1850s. And then in 1863, he marries Amelia Folsom. That's one of those instances, as Morris referenced, in which there was a very large age difference. I think she was 24 and he was 61, or something like that. And Brigham Young very much seems to have fallen in love with her late in life. You know, she became a frequent companion at the Salt Lake Theater. She would travel with him to St. George in the winter during the last several years of his life. She never had any children by Brigham Young. But he very much seemed to be very taken with her. In terms of domestic arrangements, in general, neither Brigham Young nor his wives were overly forthcoming about such matters. You know, there was one, Augusta Adams Cobb, who wrote in letters that she felt neglected sexually and very much wanted to have a child with Brigham Young. She was about 50 at the time, so it probably wasn't very likely. Other than that, though, it's very hard to say what those sorts of intimate arrangements were, John.
Right. A lot of listeners want to know, how wealthy was Brigham Young? Where did his wealth come from? And was there anything suspicious or untoward about his wealth?
Well, most of his wealth came from real estate. That, you know, when the pioneers arrived in the Salt Lake Valley, they laid out a plat, it was called, for the city, and high-ranking church leaders got large and, you know, what later became very valuable pieces of land, and that land appreciated considerably. Brigham Young was also granted economic concessions by the Deseret and Utah legislature, water and timber rights. I don't really remember the specifics. Those sorts of things added to his wealth as well. You know, he almost was a one man economic engine and bank for the territory as well. Lots of people were in debt to him. He was the fulcrum of a lot of economic activity. Later on, his position, you know, both his wealth and his standing as church leader facilitated his ability to get contracts to build telegraph and railroad lines in Utah. In terms of whether there's anything suspicious or untoward about his wealth, he ultimately, you know, at one point has a wealth of maybe $2 million or so, which is a lot of money, say around 1870. His wealth generates some resentment among church members, most of whom are very impoverished, or at least among some church members. I don't know if I'd say there's anything untoward about it. I mean, you know, if you think that it's, you know, callous for a man to accumulate wealth when many others don't have very much, you know, I mean, that I suppose that's one way to look at it. I'm not sure that's the only way to look at it, though.
Yeah, I mean, he was the leader of a large people. He had a lot of families. He certainly had sacrificed a lot and probably felt like he needed to not have to worry about financial things to be able to govern and take care of the people. So, I mean,
yeah. Well, I mean, I think he felt he needed, you know, a pretty impressive residence for entertaining, you know, especially non-Mormon visitors from the East. I mean, but, you know, that charge is made against so many religious and political leaders, you know, down to the present day. You know, that charge is of accumulating too much wealth is made against men like Joel Osteen, you know, the megachurch pastor in Houston today. If you think that religious leaders should remain poor and give away their wealth to the poor, then you might have a problem with Brigham Young's accumulation of wealth. But you know, he did become very wealthy.
Right. One of the really interesting dynamics of the sort of Salt Lake Brigham Young period, as I understand it, were sort of these epic doctrinal battles between Brigham Young and I believe it was Orson Pratt. Is that right?
That's right.
Can you talk about what those were about and how Orson Pratt felt like he had any right to be debating with the prophet and why the prophet would even entertain such debates if he had sort of consummate power? What were those debates about and how did Orson Pratt not get in big trouble for him?
Well, he did get in a lot of big trouble.
So what were they about? How did they start?
Well, you know, I think the theological disputes mostly start with Young's identification of Adam as humanity's God.
Did he get that from Joseph Smith?
I don't think he got that from Joseph Smith. I think it was one possible way to work out what Joseph had introduced. You know, for instance, you know, the belief that Adam played a significant role in the creation of the world, I think was present in the Nauvoo endowment ceremony. Joseph Smith talked about God having God being a man like yourselves. There did seem to be, you know, that part of the plan of salvation was there. And for Brigham Young, I think for him, it was logical that Adam had come to this world as an exalted, resurrected human being. And, you know, I think from there, he simply said that Adam is the only God with which we have to deal. You know, and he was uncertain about the, you know, hierarchy of divine beings beyond Adam. But he suggested that human beings on Earth should regard Adam as their God. That raised all sorts of questions. Didn't seem to square very readily with the Book of Genesis. You know, some people wondered, does that mean that we should pray to Adam? It was one of those things that Brigham Young introduced that met with a fair amount of opposition. And Orson Pratt also opposed it. That's not the only theological topic on which they clash, but it seems to have precipitated a lot of division. There are others that I detail in the book. I think Brigham Young would have been okay with Orson Pratt sitting in his office and chatting about these matters and having some differences of opinion. What Brigham Young was unwilling to tolerate was the fact that Orson Pratt would also talk about these things and express doubts about what Brigham Young was saying, not so much publicly, but with other church members. And when Brigham Young confronted Pratt about what he considered to be disobedience, Pratt would... You know, he was resistant. You know, he wasn't quite willing to simply accept what Brigham was saying as the word of the Lord. And Brigham Young wanted him to, and he wanted him to publicly submit to his theological leadership. Pratt eventually does so, but it takes a great amount of arm twisting. And, you know, Brigham Young doesn't really ever... feel assured of Pratt's obedience to him.
It's almost like a Henry VIII, Sir Thomas More kind of interaction, it seems like.
Yeah, maybe something along those lines. And, you know, he also had a tremendous clash with Orson Pratt when he moved to reconstitute a church presidency in late 1847. And they had very heated, animated discussions about that at the time. I think, you know, ultimately, what kept Pratt, you know, Pratt remains within the church and ultimately becomes submissive to Brigham Young. And Brigham Young does say that, you know, if you chopped Orson Pratt up into 1,000 pieces, each one of them would cry out, Mormonism is true. So I think, you know, I think ultimately Young wanted to keep Pratt within the church. But it was a pretty uncomfortable relationship. And, you know, one of the things that is not so pleasant about Brigham Young was that he would stand up and publicly denounce and chastise men like Orson Pratt at, you know, Sunday meetings, for instance. And his, you know, other church leaders really did not enjoy that method of leadership.
One of the ironies, too, about the Orson Pratt Brigham Young dispute is that Orson really won the war in the sense that we no longer believe in the Adam God theory. So maybe he's having the last laugh in his grave somewhere.
there's definitely some truth there. Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of, you know, there are some people who were convinced by Brigham Young, but it's one of those teachings that fades away pretty quickly after his death. He, you know, he brings this up in the 1850s and then sets it aside in the face of opposition. He returns to it in the 1870s, and it's present, very present at the St. George Temple dedication, but it doesn't convince most Latter-day Saints.
Right. So we're late in talking about this in the chronology, but I guess any discussion of Brigham Young would be remiss without talking about his views on race and the historical timeline of Joseph ordaining blacks to the priesthood, yet somehow by the time Brigham Young is governing in Utah, blacks aren't able to participate as they had under Joseph Smith. Can you talk about that and to what extent we should, you know, rush off and call Brigham Young a racist versus to what extent we should just say, hey, he's a product of his time and let's cut him some slack. He wasn't certainly the only racist person or person who had views like this in 19th century America.
Yeah, well, I mean, the latter point you make is definitely true. I mean, outside of John Brown, it's hard to find non-racist white people in mid-19th century America. Really hard. So then I guess you're talking about degrees of racism. And, you know, in terms of Brigham Young's earlier opinions about black people, it's hard to find much. There's one positive reference to a black man in one of his missionary diaries. But otherwise, we don't know a whole lot. You know, there certainly were black men ordained to the priesthood during Joseph Smith's lifetime. I don't know if that's so much because Joseph Smith was terribly egalitarian on the matter of race. He's, you know, he kind of goes back and forth on the issue of abolition, but does include abolition as part of his platform when he runs for the presidency in 1844. And there's no sense that he's opposed to the ordination of people of African descent into the priesthood. There's no sense that Brigham Young initially is opposed to it either. You know, there's some rather egalitarian statements that he makes early in 1847. But then by the end of 1847, his views seem to harden considerably. He's horrified at the report of a black-white marriage between a white female church member and a black church member. And that specter of intermarriage seems to push him to lots of talk about black people being under a divine curse, usually because of them being descendants of Cain, and therefore not being fit or not able to hold the priesthood until God lifts that curse. And certainly there's very tough rhetoric about intermarriage from Brigham Young during these years as well. So, you know, I think that's in a nutshell how I would explain it. I don't think it actually makes sense to lay all of this on Brigham Young. You know, we speculated earlier about what other church leaders might have done, but quite a few American churches move from egalitarian or radical roots on issues of race and slavery to more conservative positions during the 19th century. The Methodists and Baptists in the South both did so. So I don't think became
more, we'll say, racist than they had been previously.
Yeah, more accepting of slavery and more racist. So it's not too surprising to me that as the church grows, Mormonism moves in that direction as well. And there's an awful lot of bitter and virulent racism in the American West in particular during this time period, often in places like Utah with very tiny numbers of black people. So, you know, Brigham Young puts these ideas in a way that's somewhat distinctive, but I don't think his positions are incredibly surprising. I think the fact that he expressed them with such vehemence and sometimes with prophetic authority made it much more difficult for the church to back away from them later on. And I think in terms of Mormons and race, the surprising part of the story is the persistence of these views into the, you know, the late 20th century. It's not that Brigham Young embraced these views in the middle of the 19th century. I don't mean to, you know, excuse views that I and I'm sure most readers will find repugnant, but you know, ultimately people are a product of their times and their experiences. I don't think it's because, you know, Brigham Young had a particularly evil gene in this respect.
Right. Anything remarkable about his views on women that you found?
You know, in terms of his views on women, it's one of those cases in which he said so many things over the span of 30 years that are often contradictory that it's a little bit hard to know what to make of them. I do think he became, you know, his most misogynistic comments came in the first half decade or so after he becomes the church's leader. And I think toward the end of his life, he was more able to recognize the ecclesiastical talents and contributions of women like Zina Huntington and Eliza Snow. So he becomes, I think, you know, at first he clearly doesn't want the reestablishment of Relief Society and later supports it. So I think there is some evolution of his thought in that area.
I suppose this would play into that question a little bit as well, and we alluded to it earlier, but Brigham Young, not only in his own family, but in other families, was fairly lax at permitting divorces to occur. In other words, if a woman didn't like her situation in marriage, he wasn't loath to let her leave. Is that your understanding?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, and people would come to him, and he's kind of like an ancient Israelite judge. People would come to him with all sorts of problems, and not infrequently, people brought their marital problems to him. And, you know, he didn't follow, you know, some 21st century guide on marital counseling. You know, people would come and tell him that their husbands were abusive, and oftentimes he would say, well, you know, give it one more try. I'll send a message to the husband or have the bishop talk to him. And if it can't work, you can have a divorce. I mean, he once wrote this letter to an abusive husband saying, you know, if you don't reform, I am going to send someone to visit you in a very, you know, tone suggesting that this man was going to have serious trouble if he didn't mend his ways. So, I mean, his, you know, he gave all sorts of advice for different situations, but you're quite right. He was pretty liberal in terms of granting divorces. He did also at the same time say that, you know, granting divorces wouldn't necessarily cancel an eternal sealing. So maybe it's not quite that simple, but he would at least allow women to get out of, very difficult marriage arrangements, and he often would then, sanction remarriages.
You know, John, there's an interesting anecdote that you mention in your book, and this is clearly an outlier, but I found it fascinating as to Brigham Young's personality. Maybe you can tell because I don't remember the name actually of the people involved, the names, but there was a woman who wanted to have children and her husband was impotent. And so Brigham Young essentially gave her permission to have children by another man, which she did, and then went back to her husband. Maybe you can tell the story better.
Well, people should definitely read the story in the book. It was fascinating, and I had seen references to it in a couple of other books, but I found some of the sources for myself, which, you know, at first I was kind of skeptical that he actually gave that advice. But there's a woman named Mary Richardson whose husband was impotent. And I think because of that, she was worried that this would limit, not just simply their ability to have children, but to receive the, you know, full celestial blessings that they might have otherwise been able to expect. And so Young writes to Mary Richardson, she doesn't want to cast off her husband entirely, but she's got this problem. And his response is, if I was imperfect and had a good wife, I would call on some good brother to help me that we might have increase. And then they would get all of the celestial blessings in the temple that they might otherwise anticipate. And so he gives Mary Richardson a temporary civil marriage to another member of her community. She has two sons with this man, and then she returns with those sons to her prior husband. So that's kind of an example of very ad hoc marital advice, and I do think it's an outlier, but Brigham Young felt that he could just take these cases as they came and devise a practical solution.
Wow, that seems kind of progressive.
Today we could solve it by other scientific methods, but in those days they didn't exist.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, impotency, he regarded as you know, that serious of a obstacle to a marriage that I think he was willing to entertain that solution. And Mary Richardson's husband Edmund seemed to accept the arrangement, actually, Edmund Richardson requests that Young eventually adopt him as a son, you know, through that ordinance of adoption. So both parties seem to be on board with the arrangement.
Fascinating. Thanks for bringing that up, Morse. Real quick, John, and I hope this doesn't put you in an uncomfortable position, but while we're on the topic of Brigham Young's sort of doctrinal explorations and cultural commentary, what do you make of the fact that the church seems to be, LDS Church now seems to be distancing itself from a lot of the statements Brigham Young, a lot of the teachings and statements that Brigham Young made? Do you feel like they're sort of walking away from Brigham Young, or that Brigham Young's mark is still very much all over, 21st century Mormonism? Does it make you a little bit sad, or have you even, are you even aware of maybe some of Brigham Young's teachings falling a bit out of fashion in church correlation today?
Yeah. Well, I don't consider myself any sort of expert on contemporary Mormonism. But, you know, certainly the church has distanced itself from doctrines such as blood atonement or Adam God, certainly. What else do you have in mind, John?
It's a bit of an uncomfortable question to ask.
I'm happy to engage it. I mean, I think Brigham Young is most comfortable as a pragmatic, pioneering prophet. He's less comfortable as a theological leader, and less comfortable as a political leader, I think, in many ways as well. You know, his communitarian economic policies would be another example of something that ultimately was abandoned. You know, I still think Brigham Young has a very clear legacy for the church today, at least the church within the United States. Well, and I'd say more broadly. I mean, Brigham Young, and this is not something that's often associated with him, he very much was a temple builder, not just in Nauvoo, but, you know, laying the foundations for multiple temples in Utah. You know, he could have just begun work and completed a temple in Salt Lake City, but he instead decides that there should be temples in St. George, in Manti, in Logan. And he talks about, you know, one day that there should be temples across North and South America, that there should be thousands of temples. And now there are nearly 150. And I think, you know, his spiritual legacy in that respect is very pronounced, and something that moved Mormonism forward as something very different from mainstream American Christianity. So I think that's a very clear legacy. I think, you know, this, what you might call it, kind of pioneer era ethic of self-sufficiency, industry, and cooperation. I think those are still
very
much part of Mormon culture and a very valued part of Brigham Young's legacy. So, you know, it'd be nicer, I suppose, to if you could just have Brigham Young without the rough edges. But, you know, I think his influence is still there.
This is probably an impossible question to ask, but just for the fun of it, I'm going to ask. Do you think that if Joseph, you know, just Joseph Smith and Brigham were, you know, within 5 years of age, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Do you think if Joseph had lived as long as Brigham, have you been able to, learn about them both enough to know whether you think Joseph could have taken the church as far and as high and grown it as much as Brigham did? Do you even have a way to theorize or speculate about that, or is that too hard of a question to ask?
Well, historians are totally unqualified to render judgment about things that didn't happen. It's hard enough to figure out what actually did happen, yeah. And it's even harder to explain what happened. So, you know, we're only kind of looking through a glass darkly at actual events from the past. But since you asked, I'm still happy to answer the question. I mean, my sense of Joseph Smith is certainly a religious genius that had great difficulties with the practical side of leadership. You know, you have a church that totally collapses in Kirtland. And Joseph Smith and Brigham Young basically have to flee from creditors and really flee from their lives. And then you have, you know, you certainly have a lot of external pressure in Missouri, but you also have, you know, a collapse of the church from within, which we talked about earlier. And in Nauvoo, you again have dissent within the church, creating all sorts of difficulties. And I think you could also say Joseph's innovations creating a lot of difficulty. So with Brigham Young, you know, it's a different story. You know, he brags that the church did not experience 10% of the descent under his leadership as it had under Joseph's. So in terms of how things would have turned out if Joseph had lived and Brigham Young had not become the church's leader in the mid-1840s, you know, based on, you know, based on the events in Ohio, Missouri, and Nauvoo, I don't think the outlook for
Joseph,
you know, kind of practical institution building would have been very good. I'm sure others view those elements of Joseph Smith's leadership differently. But that, I suppose that's my gut feeling about things, which one should just take with a grain of salt.
Interesting.
And one thing we really haven't talked about, I don't know that we need to, but just the colonization and empire building that Brigham Young instituted, the ability to get church members to leave their comfortable homes in settled areas and go to really godforsaken places and start communities. Amazing that he was able to accomplish that. One wonders whether Joseph Smith would have had that same ability.
Yeah, I mean, who knows? And not all of Brigham's colonization ideas or economic missions worked out, but nevertheless, things really held together under his leadership. And people undertook tremendous sacrifices to attempt what he asked. And, you know, I've certainly described him as a pretty hard-fisted leader, and I think he was. He was very authoritarian. But that wouldn't have been enough to motivate people to follow him. So it's not as if he simply ruled by fear. You know, I think his practical accomplishments earned him a lot of respect. And many Latter-day Saints very much looked up to him as the church's prophet and savior, even, if you will, as their Moses.
Right. So, John Turner, just a couple more questions. You've been really generous with your time. I want to leave Brigham Young himself for a second. I'm going to return to him at the end and ask you to tell us a story that shows the toughest side of Brigham Young and then maybe the most sympathetic or inspirational part of Brigham Young is kind of the way to close. But let's just talk just a tiny bit about what it was like to interact with, you know, church archives, church history. You know, there's a perception among some who maybe aren't as informed that the church is really restrictive in its access to archives, that the church is trying to hide all sorts of things. Was that your experience? You know, what was your experience trying to access the, you know, some what I would guess to be sensitive documents and maybe even documents that others haven't been able to access? Talk about that if you don't mind.
Sure. Well, the issue of access was very important in terms of writing the biography that I wanted to write. And so embarking on the project, I really didn't know ultimately how that would turn out. You know, I sought to build relationships with people in the church history department and at the archives. But it, you know, it's not as if we had a conversation 5 years ago and there was any sort of agreement about how things would go. I just kind of asked for things when I needed them, and kept asking. And you know, ultimately, I was able to use all of the Brigham Young papers, which are extensive and do contain a lot of intimate and, be fair to say, controversial material about everything ranging from his plural marriages to his clashes with other church leaders. And many other collections were opened to me as well, was turned down on a few requests. And I can't really speak about the experiences of other people, but I did sense a desire to help. And I don't know, I'm very grateful for that. I think it would be certainly be simpler if everybody could just see everything. I also was, I certainly was not coming to the project as any sort of academic big shot. So, I think it's a pretty encouraging sign if somebody with, limited record of publication and accomplishments can show up and get a tremendous amount of cooperation. And I've even noticed that the people at the archives are quite good about trying to help. Even people working on projects without, an academic position or anything like that. So, I think I showed up at a pretty good time. I think in general, there's more openness than there was 10 or 20 years ago, and I certainly benefited from that.
What were the documents you weren't allowed to see?
George Q. Cannon's journal, which I really wanted to see because the sources on Brigham Young's later years are not as good, and I thought there could be some relevant information there. What else? That was the most important one.
Council 50 minutes, is that right?
I didn't ask.
Okay.
I thought, I first of all, I thought, I had enough from either typescripts or diaries about the Council of 50 during those years. And I mean, I asked for an awful lot of stuff. And I don't know. I didn't think that would be the most intelligent
Ask.
battle to wage, so to speak. There are some minutes of prayer circles in the 1850s that I didn't get access to.
William Clayton's journals are some of them are published, but not all, correct?
Not all, but I think, I think the most valuable parts probably have been. Just to give, I mean, to give you a better sense, there are vast collections of typescripts made of all sorts of documents and collections that a woman named Edith Romney made, I think mostly in the 70s and 80s, which I think Leonard Arrington and his researchers relied on pretty heavily for American Moses. As I was able to see what I at least think was the entirety of those collections, which are tremendously vast. I know that the George D. Watt transcripts of Brigham Young's discourses, his sermons, are now available. Not just available to me in my case, but available more generally. So, there are a lot of things that are restricted at the archives. I hope that other researchers have experiences akin to my own.
So overall, pretty happy.
I was very happy.
Yeah.
And like I said, again, I'm really coming at it as, I just imagine that when I showed up and said I want to write a biography of Brigham Young, and I don't have any background in Mormon history, I'm sure some people just thought I was nuts, which I probably was. So I mean, I especially, I think if, I don't know, if I was some Pulitzer Prize winning historian and I was showing up, I kind of might think that I would get treated with extra, care and concern, but I kind of thought I got a lot of that even being a relative nobody.
Right. Were there any, I don't want to put you in the position of, leaving names out or feeling like you have to name people, but overall, how did you find the general Mormon history community? Were they helpful at all in writing this book? And were there any particular people who sort of stood out as being really helpful, or was this more of just a solo effort?
I got a lot of help from all sorts of people who are part of the Mormon history community. I mentioned many of them in the acknowledgement, so I don't really want to
check that out.
I single out a few there, so but beyond that, no, I got a tremendous amount of help, and kind of the standard thing for acknowledgments is, nobody's responsible for my mistakes. Those are all mine, but right. I know that many friends saved me from a lot of mistakes, and the Mormon history community is remarkable. It's so vibrant, so active, and there's so many different sorts of people who participate in the expansion of our knowledge and understanding about the Mormon past. And that was a real pleasure in terms of the project, was getting to know so many wonderful people. And in fact, when I thought about, do I want to do more projects on Mormonism in the future or not? The more ready opportunity to continue those relationships and friendships is it's definitely a factor. It's one thing that makes me want to do more of this.
Wow, that's great to hear. Well, Morris, I'm going to ask him that closing question already listed. But are there any final questions you want to ask of John Turner before we ask him to wrap up?
I don't think so. I think you should get to the wrap up.
All right. So John Turner, let's just leave. I think there are those who kind of see Brigham Young just really simply as the bold prophet that carried Mormonism into the Utah Times and beyond, courageous and saving of the church. And then there's those who kind of maybe view him as a tough guy and as an unpleasant guy and as a rough guy and maybe even as a violent man. Let's just end with maybe a story or two that sort of illustrate both, but I want to end on the one that maybe is a little bit more emotional or touching or inspirational, just to maybe leave us with two or three of your favorite stories that made the biggest impact on you about Brigham Young.
Well, great question. There's so many stories. First of all, when you're blessed with an abundance of primary sources that are contemporaneous, I think people emerge as just so, so very human. So, I feel like I got many glimpses, many glimpses of Brigham Young in that respect. Let me just close with one story, John, that I think illustrates both the rougher and the more tender elements of Brigham Young's personality. The first president of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles was a man named Thomas Marsh. And he's among those who fell away from the church and betrayed the church in Missouri. And Brigham Young often had rather unkind things to say about him afterwards, as you might expect. And then in the mid-1850s, Thomas Marsh wants to come to Utah and have a reconciliation with the church. And he seems a bit maybe mentally imbalanced by this time. He's certainly physically diminished. And Brigham Young tells him to come to Utah. And he gets to Salt Lake City just as the Utah War is brewing. And in early September 1857, Brigham Young publicly denounces him in front of the people. So it's not exactly a warm welcome. He basically says, one good reason not to apostatize is that you might end up like Thomas Marsh, this withered, pitiable figure. And so that, just seemed incredibly cruel to some extent, though I think, you know, understanding the history of Missouri maybe tempers that a little bit. But then after that, Brigham Young was much more tender toward Thomas Marsh. Marsh, I don't think he had any money or any source of income in Utah. And Brigham Young gave him clothes and other forms of charity. At least once in a while, Brigham Young would invite Thomas Marsh into his office, and they would sing hymns together. Brigham Young liked to sing songs of Zion that they would have sung together back in the 1830s. And I like that narrative because, first of all, it shows a Brigham Young and Brigham Young with relationships that are shaped by these early years of church history. And it shows a side that could be vindictive. It also shows a side that could be tender, maybe more likely to be tender after someone has become submissive, but nevertheless. So I think, you know, a story like that highlights the complexity and humanity of Brigham Young's personality.
Right. Well, that's a great story to illustrate the complexity of this man. Let me just encourage every single listener to buy 10 copies of this book. Christmas is quickly approaching. And this book belongs on every Mormon bookshelf, in my opinion. The book is Brigham Young, Pioneer Prophet. The author is John G. Turner. It's published by Harvard University Press. And it's not only available through Amazon. Tell us where else it's available.
Well, yeah, most of the usual places. It is being carried by Deseret Book, and as far as I know, is in a lot of Deseret bookstores. So if listeners happen to live near Deseret, they can buy it there as well.
And that's sort of, you know, for the more, let's just say, conservative members, that's, you know, a bit of a statement saying that this passed the approval process for those who might worry that the book is trying to do any harm to the church. I think that speaks well for everyone who I've talked to about this book in addition, which have all said that it's a very fair, interesting, compelling, and extremely valuable contribution to Mormon history with very credible scholarship. So our top commendations to you, John Turner, for an excellent book. Thank you so much.
Thanks. It was a pleasure talking to both you, John, and you, Morris.
Well, it was good for me to be here, John, and I'll just echo what John DeLynn said. I found the book to be fascinating. I think it's a must-read for anyone interested in Mormon history, in the same sense that Rough Stone Rolling was a must-read if you wanted to know Joseph Smith better.
Wow, that's a great endorsement, Morris. And Morris, thanks for joining us today as well. You've been a fantastic contributor to Mormon Stories now and in the past. So thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
All right, so please go to mormonstories.org if you want to make comments and discuss this podcast or the book. We also invite you to join the Facebook group Mormon Stories Book Club, where you can actually ask direct questions to John Turner. And most importantly, if you want to hold book clubs in your local area, and you can get enough people together to buy John's book and make a strong showing, John would even be willing to maybe schedule a Skype appearance at your book club to help be a part of that book club. So please buy this book, buy it for friends and family, support Mormon Stories Book Club. You can get that link at Amazon on mormonstories.org. Thanks to everyone for listening, and please tune in again soon. You guys take care. Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. Music today was provided by the Saber Rattlers. Check them out at saber-rattlers.com. The Mormon Stories logo was generously donated by StudioCase.com. Thanks for listening.
Come, come, ye saints, no toil nor labor fear, but with joy wend your way. Though hard to you, journey may appear, grace shall be as your day. Tis better far for us to strive our useless cares from us to drive to the sand joy. Your hearts will swell. Journey's through.